you remember my massive banana?
Smith, I've got that photo. It never leaves my computer.
Hello, you are listening to Off Radar, It's a Movie podcast. I'm James Smith, a professional film and video editor.
I'm James Etock, a freelance writer and illustrator specialising in 1980s cartoons.
And I'm Neil Brock, aka Nige, the man with two names, former film journalist and currently working in the games industry.
Each week, one of us picks a movie that all three of us either haven't seen in many years or in some cases haven't seen at all.
We each watch the chosen movie, return to the microphone and let you all know exactly what we thought of it.
I'd never really had any interest in watching it and I was proved absolutely right.
I think it's amazing. I really, really love this film.
The film's still a pile of steaming dog shit.
If you fancy joining in and suggesting a movie for us to watch, why not tweet us at offradarpodcast
or email us on offradarpod@gmail.com.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, share, and by all means, leave a review.
For now, strap in, turn the volume up, and let's go
off radar.
I just need a really quick wee-wee, then we'll crack on.
I need to do a wee-wee.
Yeah. I did my wee-wee.
Hello and welcome back to Off Radar. I'm James Smith and I am joined by Neil Brock.
Hello!
Let's get ready to rumble. And James Etock.
Hello.
We call Neil Brock Nige, by the way. Today we're talking about a film that came out in 2020... two, so quite recent, called RRR. Now, this was a film that was recommended by Chris Kiernan. He recommended...
Oh, C to the K.
He recommended a film quite a while ago called Get Out, which we've also done on the pod, and this was one of his other choices. Had we ever seen this film before we did it for the pod, guys?
I'd not seen it, but I'd heard a lot about it. Last year, so I was anxious to see it, but I don't know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, when would I actually have seen it? There's a bunch of Marvel films that I still haven't seen, mind you, I've checked out of that universe. But this was one I'd heard so many good things about. The only thing that ever put me off was the runtime, which I was very aware of. I was like, ooh,
yes,
yeah, that's going to be a tough sit, regardless of how good or bad the film is. So I
first time
I'd heard of it, was anxious to watch it, and I've watched it. What about Nige? Cut to Nige.
Here comes Nige.
Here comes Nige.
From my side, very, very similar to what Etox just said, in fact. Heard a lot about it. So there was, like, certainly on the likes of Reddit and social media, it was something that got talked about quite a lot. But I hadn't had the opportunity to check it out. It was one of those that I had on the back burner. And it was that question mark of, is my wife going to enjoy this film? Or is this going to have to be one that I just watched by myself? And lo and behold, I ended up doing it by myself for this lovely podcast.
Interesting. I hadn't actually heard of it, which is kind of crazy when you look at how much it grossed and how well it's done since, and one of the most popular ever streams on Netflix. But yeah,
I haven't looked at any of the Wikipedia or box office or anything. I don't even know how this film was received. I heard it was recommended, that's it.
Oh, that's very interesting. So in terms of how it was received, it's sort of been a bit of a sensation, I would suggest, with even Jimmy Cameron himself saying to the director, if he ever wants to do an American film, to kind of look him up. That's, I think, within the filmmaking community, it was very well received.
Wow.
And critically as well. But what about the Off-Radar boys? What are they
Well,
think?
That's why we're here. But I watched...
that's why we're here.
So I straight up started watching this on Netflix, which is where it's available in the UK. And when I started watching it, automatically it played the dubbed English version. Which I got about 15 minutes in, and then I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right. So I then switched it to the only other the option for Indian, which is Hindi. Which made it feel slightly more authentic. However, the original language, it's worth pointing out that this is not a Bollywood film, which is Hindi. It's a Tollywood film, which is the Telugu language, which I didn't really realise that there were these Tollywood, Bollywood and other woods.
Although I will say from what I did read prior, or what I heard before, was that it was still celebrated as a Bollywood film. You know, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's the way I'd kind of heard it promoted as well.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, fair enough. So, so anyway, I had a weird thing where I've kind of watched the English for a bit, and then I've watched the Hindi, but there isn't the option to watch the native language on Netflix. I don't know if you guys...
Yeah, there was some people who sort of were kicking off about that on social, but it sounds a lot like Once Upon a Time in the Westmith, where you watched it in German for a good 15 minutes before realising. So I'm glad you've brought that back to the table. But yeah, I also watched it with English subtitles. I don't actually know what the audio track was, unfortunately.
But I think having the subtitles on was, you know, is how I would prefer to watch this type of film.
Yeah,
although,
yeah,
you know, a lot of people will watch this film with the dubbed English, even if they don't really realise.
Yeah, the only time I ever really enjoyed dubbed English films was the Jackie Chan films of the 1980s, because they had like the regular voice cast that would do the films, the ones released by Golden Harvest. And because obviously, you know, martial arts films and stuff, the kind of dubbing added to the fun of it. This film, though, I couldn't imagine watching a dub of this. I went straight in with the original language version.
So you did watch the original?
Yeah.
Okay. But first of all, I am going to attempt, and I apologise up front, I am not going to be able to pronounce these people properly, but bear with me, who it was written, directed by, etc. So it's directed by S.S. Rajamouli. It's written by S.S. Rajamouli, Virender Prasad, and Sai Madhav Bura. And it stars N.T. Rama Ray Jr., who plays Bahim, or Akta. And then Ram Charan, who plays Raju or Ram, Ajay Devan, who is the dad, who's, yeah, I think quite big in this field, Aaliyah Bhatt, Shira Saran, Olivia Morris, there's an even easy one, Ray Stevenson, who's the kind of beardy, like...
Oh, you butchered that last one, Smith. Ray Stevenson.
I was waiting for, like, Bob Smith, and he was going to butcher that.
And then popping up, probably the only person that I kind of recognise, I went, I recognise her. Where's she been in? Alison Doody, who was in Last
Indiana
Crusade.
Oh, my God, that was her.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm watching the film, and I'm thinking, like...
That's what she's I did.
Got, you know, I didn't even think to look at her up afterwards. Yeah, the blonde woman from the British Empire.
Yeah,
the
evil. Like Samantha, the evil. Is it, I think? And she was also in A View to a Kill as a Bond girl.
Oh, wow.
And Major League 2 as well. So there you go. So she had a sort of good period, I'd say, around like the 90s. And then she hasn't done that much in recent times. And this was her first film sort of in India, essentially. So yeah, and what a film to choose in terms of getting your box office taking suddenly up. So
RRR is set in the 1920s, where the British Empire are colonising by gaining control and power over indigenous people. At the start of the film...
British Empire are dicks. Just as they are, the British Empire are dicks.
Yeah, and that is definitely portrayed like that in this film. At the start of the film, they kidnap a young, talented girl called Marley. Enraged by the kidnapping and mutilation of his tribe, Bahim, or the actor N.T. Rama Rao Jr., embarks on a journey to try and free her and bring retribution. Meanwhile, A. Rama Raju is working as an Indian officer for the Empire and is kind of sent undercover to stop this impending threat. So the two men meet, unaware of who each other actually are. They form this bond before everything is kind of uncovered and blows up, quite literally, with explosions, dancing, singing, fighting, and 3 hours worth of it.
That's accurate.
Where to begin?
I'm guessing at the start.
Fire! Brace yourself for wrong.
It we complain about Brexit and modern day UK life, but Jesus, yeah, the British Empire have been shitty buggers for a very long time. And being a British podcast with three British men, it's quite sobering to see this and think, oh yeah, that's part of our heritage. And we were not very nice. And it's made very clear we are, as in the Brits, are the bad guys of this film, and quite
and
right.
Really interestingly as well, we've kind of discussed this briefly on the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom one. You know, quite often in Hollywood, in, you know, we've seen Indian people demonized on screen, so it's really interesting seeing it from a different point of view and seeing how the Empire was, but not being kind of saved by this white savior like Indiana Jones, who comes in and like saves the day. So, you know, we are seeing it from their point of view from every part of this film.
What I love about this movie is right from the beginning, it just shows the, yes, this is a fantasy to some degree, the film, but it does show the kind of brutal things that probably did happen, and the things that they didn't even consider the Indian people or the people whose countries they were invading, which is what they were doing, to be worth anything really. And so the opening scene is very incredibly powerful and brutal one at times, where this young girl Mally is in the village and she's painting Catherine's hand, and it's very much the way it's presented is it's really beautifully shot, in the sense of it's like this, almost like this queen sat on a throne with all this village around just utterly scared to do anything, because there's all these, you know, officers around and everything, and there's the big kind of guy who's running this part of the British Empire.
It's so terrifying. You see that innocence of her, don't you? Contrasted with the kind of, like you say, that brutality, but also the setting as well. You know, the forest is vibrant, yeah, and green, and you know, there's big aerials right from the off, and it's, yeah, really sold to you that they are part of the land. And it's said throughout, yes, the whole film, you know, they're part of water and, you know, like that, all of that, but also part of nature.
Yes,
and that's kind of right up front.
Yeah, that's something that recurs in the film that I'm sure we'll talk about, is the fire water motif. Yeah. You got Behem from this tribe that is, you like you say, of the earth, of the water, and Raju, who we meet soon,
yeah,
is, as we find out later in the movie, is from a tribe that is kind of, its motif is fire. So you get this fire water thing that is hinted at early on in the movie, and then it really connects at the end, where you're like, oh wow, this has all come together very nicely.
Well, just to say about like the tribe, like it's the Gondi tribe, and that sort of the original sort of meaning of that is outsiders, and they are a sort of quite a self-sufficient tribe, in the sense of they all look out for each other and they're very together. They're sort of based in quite a remote location in this film, and it's, as you mentioned, they're doing the painting on the hand, and they throw him a couple of coins, and everyone in the tribe just thinks, oh, it's a couple of coins for a nice bit of art, that's a fair trade, we won't kick up a stink, it's fine. But what they're actually doing is giving them a couple of coins to take this talented girl away, which suddenly causes a huge problem, obviously, for her mother, who goes chasing after him. And it ties back to your point that they're seen as so worthless by the British Empire, by the British Raj, that they don't even want to use a bullet, because it's, I think they do like the calculations. Oh, if you take into account the cost of making it and shipping it over here.
It was manufactured in an English factory using English metals. It crossed the seven seas in an English vessel. By the time it reached the barrel of your gun, it cost £1. £1 sterling. And you would want to squander it on brown rubbish. Clear the road.
When this opens, like going into this film, I knew nothing about it. I was really shocked at how brutal this, well, the whole film is, but actually the start of the film.
The start was,
I was like, oh my God, like this was not, yeah, what I was expecting. I was expecting a, you know, an outrageous, ridiculous, like, what it becomes in certain scenes, obviously. But it does... It's so brutal. They beat, like you say, beat her with a stick.
I was watching it thinking like, oh, she's dead. Yeah. Like, the mother's dead.
Oh yeah.
Spoiler, yeah. Thankfully she's not. But it's a really harrowing shot where the mother's just laying there with, like, blood coming out of the back of her head with her eyes, like, wide open. And Mally, the daughter, being carried away in, like, this fancy black British car. But you know what I mean? Being carried away in the car, and she's, like, banging on the window. And it's just... and then that scene ends, and you're like, okay. And then it's so well contrasted, because now we're at an outpost of, like, the British Empire. So they've got this kind of fenced-off area.
It's like in Delhi, and it's like...
Yeah, it's their base of operations.
Yeah,
it's their base of operations.
It's like something out of Zulu, isn't it?
Yes,
really. It's
that's
like
a great,
like,
comparison.
Remote sort of outpost, and it's surrounded by a lot of very angry locals.
But it's something this film does so well is it's, I don't want to say visual metaphors, because it sounds so wanky, but I guess it is, where one of the first shots we see of Raju is him stood there, and, like, you get, like, the first shot of him, because they're like, one of the guys in the crowd, the angry mob, for want of a better word, what is it? He throws something and it hits...
Well, it hits a royalty, like a picture, and smashes
down.
That's it.
Down. It smashes
and
down.
And then the commanding officer essentially goes...
Get that man.
Get me that. Yeah, exactly.
So it cuts to Raju, and he's silent for most of his opening scenes. But one of the first shots you see of him is him in the foreground, in the background, the British flag behind him. It's so well done, because it's like, oh, yeah, of course. You know, you had people that were Indian that were hired, incorporated into the British Empire. Like... armies have done throughout time. You know, it's, we invade a land, do you want to be with us or against us to enslave?
It's like Star Wars and the Empire, really, isn't it? Become a stormtrooper.
I don't think it's lost that the Empire is called the Empire. You know what I mean?
Wow,
it's,
very true. And they're all, like, upper class British people that are the commanders.
I think Lucas knew what he was doing with that film.
Well, even the head looks a bit like George Lucas, actually.
The commander, old Ray Stevenson.
But we get this, like, fantastic scene. So Raju is like, right, I'm going to get that guy. He doesn't say that because he's beautifully silent in this opening scene. And you're just like, what the hell? He leaps over this barbed wire fence.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
And then it's fucking incredible, because it's... I can't express how well it's done, because it's choreographed to the point where you think it's so real that it's like, I didn't think this is laughable. This is so fake. This is like a Marvel cinematic movie. It's just like, this guy is believably fighting off all these people.
Hold the line, damn it.
Glorious cinematography in it, when they all pile on top of him and he's in there, and it's almost like he's in a cave of all these people and he's fighting, and it's just the sound of them, like, yeah, ooh, and there's not like a big crowd or raucous noise, it's just the sound of him, like, struggling and fighting, and he does, and he fights his way through, and he's beating up all these people, and it's bloody glorious in terms of how energetic it is. And then he goes back to the thing and he throws the guy, he got the guy.
You get this contrast straight away between these two protagonists right at the front, because, yeah, you've got this, the rawness of this guy who, like you say, beating up all these millions of, it feels like millions of guys
seemingly,
and then the other guy, Beam, is he's basically fighting a tiger. And so the contrast between this kind of thing with animals, and I think there's a lot of symbolism in this film about animals being, like, you know, hunted by the Empire and being treated like animals. So, you know, obviously the indigenous people. So the fact that animals are used so much in this film, where they, you know, are these big kind of weird CGI looking animals, is funny. So the tiger fight is insane. You know, he's got his bulging biceps and he traps this tiger, but
They're both ripped. Both the lead characters in this film are absolutely ripped.
Loads of slow-mo, by the way. You should say that.
Can I just say, like, I was going to get onto that later in the film, but it, like, this isn't me just shitting on Zack Snyder, but this shows you how a director should use slow-mo, because Zack Snyder, I think if you took one of his films and played all the slow-mo at a standard pace, it would be like a 10-minute film. That sounds like an exaggeration. I'm sure it's not if you watch 300.
Yeah, they're unnecessary, basically. Yeah,
and a lot of his stuff is so unnecessary. I felt that a lot of the slow-mo in this really was, in this very long film, was perfectly utilised. I thought it wasn't like random shots or it wasn't wasted. It always tried to capture a moment in time, almost like a painting, a beautiful painting. And it was... I felt that every use of slow-mo, like one of the first bits is when Beam's running after, you know, he's chasing the wolf and he avoids the tiger striking him. It's just these like moments. Yeah, it kind of, it highlights, oh, that's a bit CGI-y, but it just, it captures these moments so beautifully over and over again in the film. I think on a lot of the action scenes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good point. There are moments when I thought slow-mo was sometimes unnecessary. So it was... So when they've used slow-mo, when they've shot it at that frame rate, I think I agree, it works really well. But there are moments in the film where it actually, they've just slowed it down a little bit, like when, like the piggyback type thing, when he's on his shoulders type scene. And I personally thought that it was at times overused. Not all the time, like some of the fight sequences, for instance, you know, it's not just slow-mo, it's like it's sped up, so it's like, you know, speed up, slow down, the time remapping, and it's done so well, like with the tiger, you know, you'll see him like fly into the air and then kind of pause, like I guess Matrix-y kind of style, and then, you know, carry on the fight. So, you know, like the kind of the VFX and the technology they've used throughout the whole film is it's incredible in that sense.
It's a wonderfully cinematic film. Yeah, throughout, it's incredible.
It wants to do with that, doesn't it? It tries to be exactly what it is. And I've got to be honest, like going into this, I've never really seen a Bollywood, Tollywood, whatever film. So I was really unsure what to expect and if I would like it. So you get though, but with this film, you get that contrast of the brutalness throughout the whole film with the kind of softness of the dancing scenes, which pop up.
I agree with that.
Not very much, really, as in the, you know, traditional kind of Indian dancing.
I didn't expect them to be honest. Yeah. Like, obviously, the kind of the trope is that, oh, Bollywood films are just people dancing all the time. And it's like, well, that's not true. You know, I've seen, surprisingly, a
Have
few
you?
Bollywood
yeah.
films, and it's not dance numbers every few minutes, but that's the trope because it's unlike Western cinema, which doesn't have dance numbers. But, you know, imagine being someone that watches Bollywood movies going, oh, those American movies and their long talky segments, where's the musical numbers? Where's the thing to, you know, the whole point of the Bollywood dance numbers is to often, from what I know, is to heighten the emotion of a scene or to progress a story in a fun way. And
I think the first time we see the, jumping ahead slightly, the first dance scene is that ballroom type scene.
I love it.
They start
so good.
Off like the Empire doing this dance thing, and then anyway, like it turns into the two of the guys which have now met, which we'll get to the scene before.
It's
this.
One of my favourite scenes,
and they do this incredibly choreographed
so good.
Dance. Like it's just like I was watching it, kind of like this must have taken literally years. Out.
No, Jake, I've had enough of your bullying.
Go away! No! Go!
Smith, I wrote in my notes, I went back three times to watch the scene because I couldn't believe how well choreographed it was and the amount of footwork that was involved in it, because it was you know, it was such unique dancing, but the level of, and the energy, and you just think, you know, the my only criticism I think of the scene was afterwards, they're walking back from away from the estate where they were. Obviously, we're jumping far ahead, but they're walking back from the estate where the ball was, and none of them are sweating. It's like, if you danced for like 10, 15 minutes, you would be drenched.
They never try and, you know, like, the realism of the brutality is always very real. Like there's scenes where there's torture, like the brother gets tortured. For instance, one of the most brutal scenes, and the obviously much later on the flogging scene, but with the scenes like when he's fighting like a tiger or the dancing scene and stuff like that, you don't have that realism in the same way. So it's really interesting that they use realism only in certain sections of the film, if that makes sense. I mean, like one of the most crazy scenes, which comes before this, which I just wanted to talk to before we kind of moved on, was the bridge scene where...
Well, I think that's a good point to jump onto, because that is the moment when these two characters meet, which is fantastic. You've got this this bridge that's got a train line underneath it, like carrying goods. Basically, the train derails, oil spills, oil on the water starts a fire. So this kid is, you know, it's one of those wonderful almost like plot conveniences. The kid is trapped in a ring of fire. Raju is on the bridge, and Bahim is on the ground with like his people, saying like, "How are we going to save this kid?" And this is the moment of their wonderful bromance starts, where Raju and kind of Bahim, their eyes lock, even though they're so far apart, but they just decide, okay, we're going to save this kid together.
I think that's the kind of key thing of this film, yeah, for someone who's kind of not necessarily that familiar with it. It kind of combines that craziness of like the 80s Arnie films,
yes,
for instance. That kind of, and certainly that bromance that we see in things like Predator, for instance. But it's got that kind of Matrix feel in terms of like some of the stunts, the usage of CGI. And then it's also kind of got the sort of epic tale of, I don't know, like A Far and Away, or a film that's probably a lot better than that, but that kind of it's bringing a lot of different almost cinematic experiences together and trying to make it something that is kind of fresh and original. And I know there's been a lot of talk about this being the two main characters are almost like superheroes. We've said it ourselves, like the fact they're so ripped. And I do love the intros of both of them, as we mentioned, the fighting off the kind of like Zulu horde sort of comparison, and also the fighting against the tiger. There's a bit where he kind of grabs two ropes either side and kind of pulls it together. Yeah. And you could imagine that being Arnie in an 80s film. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, they're both done really, really well. And like you say, this way of kind of getting them, you already know that they're on like two different sides of this divide. You've got the kind of almost like the Jackie Chan super cop, and then you've got like the rebel fighter, I suppose, who's tracking down the child. But they bond, and it is a beautiful like bromance.
Well, that moment when they hand clasp, and then it comes up. This is the 40-minute mark in the film, because I remember thinking like, what? They're hand clasp, and then it finally comes up what RRR means, and it says rise, roar, revolt. And I was just like, that's fucking awesome. We're 40 minutes into the film, there's a hand clasp, and then what follows is like literally a 5-minute montage of this, just them becoming friends, and it's
wonderful. Like, he goes to visit his family, isn't it? Oh, here he is, that's and all stuff like that.
It's so good.
But there's also like a song where it is like an 80s film song, in the, all the lyrics are like describing what's going on. That, like, I was saying to like Helen earlier today, partner, I was saying like, it's almost like if you went out to buy, if you wanted to make some toast, it's like, you've gone to the shop, you've gone down the aisle, you've bought a loaf of bread, you're going to
this the toast. This happens a number of times in the film as well. Like, you know, like it literally tells you what's happening, like right at the end, and it's like, no, blah, blah's going to save the day and kill a wolf.
It's crazy how well these two guys are on screen, that the chemistry between them is wicked. You get a real sense after the montage, which really does tell us these guys are friends. From that point on, that these two, there's this like wicked connection between, I keep saying wicked because it really is.
Well, and on top of that, I would say that the screen presence that these two actors have that I've never seen before are so strong as well. So Ram Charan, who plays Raju or Ram, he plays almost this villainous role for most of the film.
As we're led to believe.
Incredibly well. Like you really don't like him throughout the film because of kind of what he's done and what he stands for and stuff. And the two of them together, so Bahim is like, he is the hero, really. You know, he's the one you're rooting for. Well, I was rooting for anyway. You do get this friendship and this kind of bond between the two. But there's always a moment where you're thinking, are these two, you know, aware of who each other are? Because we are aware that, you know, he was an Indian officer, right, sent out to kind of undercover type thing. So you know that that's going to unravel at some point, which it obviously does.
Well, the lyrics say so in the song as much as anything else. But it's really interesting with, like, is it Bahim? How are we pronouncing
Bahim.
Bahim, with Beam's character, that he is like a Superman in the sense of he's dressed in a different sort of outfit. He hides all his muscles.
Yeah,
there's a scene where he's working at like a motorcycle repair type place where this sort of bully, a colonial guy, comes along and starts like beating him. And he could probably snap this guy like a twig, but he's playing the role. He's got to stay undercover. And it's brilliant seeing him go from like this almost like weakling, oh, I can't do anything against them, to like ripping off the shirt, getting the guns out, and well, as we see later in the film, basically almost staging like a one-man war against the British. And it is that sort of superhero vibe. And the two characters are actually based on real historical Indians.
Oh, wow.
So really the two guys
never met, though. They were leaders, but they never met.
They were essentially freedom fighters in India. And the director basically thought, well, all right, this is fictitious, but what if these two people met? What kind of relationship would they have? And it's almost like picking two people out of like British history.
Yeah,
like
the Western world.
Yeah, exactly. And just saying, oh, let's chuck them together. I mean, we've seen films like Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. It's not so ridiculous for us to see this. And I think there's like statues of these people in India. Like, this is how revered they are. And to give them this opportunity to kind of be on the big screen, it kind of adds to that. But it's something that's probably lost more so to us, not necessarily knowing the history or having that cultural background.
Do you fancy sending us a film to review or letting us know your thoughts on a film that we have discussed? All of your comments will be read out in our end of season leaderboard episode. Email us on offradarpod@gmail.com. Tweet us at offradarpodcast. Message us on Facebook. All links and info in the description down below.
Do it! Do it!
Basically, they learn how to get into the compound because there's two gates. And he goes away and sets it up that they're going to essentially storm the place to try and rescue his little sister. And yeah, that is an absolutely bonkers scene. Like, that is something definitely out of like an 80s film where they barge through these gates and unleash all these like captured animals on the unsuspecting sort of colonials. And then you've got our superhero stood in the middle. But then you've got our other superhero fighting on the other side because he's just been bitten by a snake. Again, this is like the levels of like ridiculous of this film.
Before this point, it becomes pretty clear to both of them that they are not who they are, and
they're on the opposite side.
Clashing.
But yeah, they're having this fight at the palace, and again, going back to what we spoke about earlier, the fire water motif comes in spectacular fashion, where Behem is like atop this fountain with these hoses, and he's holding these hoses, and they're like spraying water, and you've got Raju on the other side, still in his police officer's uniform. He'd just been made senior officer. He's in this like royal regal red kind of uniform, looking very dapper. And the firelight works are going off behind him. So he's got like fireworks and firecrackers. He's holding like, a flaming torch kind of thing. And again, it's that fire water thing. So it comes back into the movie again as the motif. And it's like these two guys from very opposing forces going at it. And yeah, and Behem is captured. And it leads to this kind of very cinematic, beautiful scene in which Behem is tortured. And then
the way it switches there as well. It's not just the flogging. He then gets given this thing with like spikes coming out of it.
From the rather sadist like Catherine, isn't it? She holds it up and it's got like loads of spikes coming out of it.
They're trying to get him to kneel to the governor or whatever it is, but he won't kneel, and he's been literally beaten to death. But he won't kneel. He'd rather die than kneel to this guy, which is incredibly symbolic.
Yeah, up until this point, we've been led to believe that Raju is this kind of traitor to his own people, and then we learn that no, right from the beginning, he was sent in to like become this weapon to fight against the British by infiltrating them, and basically we see
the inside man,
and we learn like it's a great scene where his father is kind of like teaching the children and the people of the village, like, you know, when we get guns, this is how you use one. And I think there was only like maybe one gun in the village that is held by his father. And during training, Raju as a child is like, ow. And his father's like, what's this? And there's a bruise on Raji's shoulder, and he says, "I fired the gun," and the father's just about to hit him, and like his little sister runs up and says, "Oh no, no, it's not his little sister. This one of the other little girls of the village says, no, no, let me show you what he did." And they go and they find the target that Raju as a child shot. It's like, look, there's, you know, he's like, you,
Jim
you
Bowen hit- comes out and he's like, it's a bullseye.
Let's see what you could have won. And they show the target and it's like a dead center. And he's like, so where did you fire from? Those boulders over there. And the little girl's, no, Raju fired from over there. And it's like so far away. And it turns out that Raju from a very young age is like this amazing crack shot. So when the British invade the village, when he's young, and they kill his mother, his brother, so many people of his village, including his father, Raju proves to be this crack shot. And so thus he infiltrates the British Empire in another flashback.
The ultimate kind of revenge story.
It's
infiltrate and take them down from the inside. But he has to tread on people to get there. And unfortunately, one of those people he needs to do so to get the rank, to get that position of trust Bahim. Within.
But, and then as the audience, you're also conflicted because you're like, he is pushing this so far now. He's got to the point where he's killing you know, the one person, the one man he loves.
He says
his bro.
And I was like, man, this almost is this too far, you know, like as in like these two are meant to be best mates and whatever. And obviously that's what they want you to feel, right? Because it makes you feel it. You kind of feel like he is still a villain despite the origin story, and you know, like predictably, I mean, I think I knew anyway how this film was then going to play out in the sense of the kind of coming good.
What I like about after the torture scene, when Bahim is tortured, he doesn't bend the knee, as it were. He's not going to bow down, and he sings this song and it inspires like the people who are watching this public kind of torture. Bit after the torture scene when Raju is speaking to one of his comrades and says, one of his, you know, fellow comrades in undercover, and says, you know, Bahim, you know, I think guns are the answer, and yet Bahim inspired hundreds upon hundreds of people just through a song. And it's like, that is wicked, because it's like all the guns, don't get me wrong, guns obviously are very effective, but to inspire people, you hope. It's not a gun, is it? It's hope. It's that kind of inspiration. It's like a really beautiful story. And then later on in the film, just a little bit later, Bahim realizes like my mission was so narrow minded of just rescue my sister, whereas Raju's was so much bigger. And it's that wonderful kind of parallel between the contrast.
And especially with Raju's one, his is give everybody a gun type thing, isn't it? So or something like that. I think he tries to.
Well, that's his initial thing. Yeah. He's all about the guns, and then he realizes that Bahim's way of kind of inspiring people is just
which
as effective as holding
obviously
a rifle.
The kind of symbolism through this whole fire and water thing, so, which we.
Again, like fire is the aggressive, like bang, and water is the poetic nature. Very, very nice.
Which happens quite a lot throughout the film, and sometimes you might not notice it. Sometimes it's literally like, you know, the bridge, the fire, like you said, and the water. And then there's scenes throughout the whole film where the fire and water is present. I mean, it happens a lot in the end scene.
The third act of the movie.
It's
very much like
here it is. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with his bow and arrow and a but like Captain Planet. Your powers Planet. Combined.
I got rings on and then Don Cheadle comes out and it's
Don
funny
Cheadle.
Die.
Oh, nice reference there.
Some of the choreography of the fight scenes, I mean, we said it, like, they are like a dance, because, I mean, we've talked about, you know, like Bollywood in kind of being associated with, or Tollywood being associated with dancing, but the fight scenes are also choreographed like a dance. They're often, you know, like the way they will drag someone or flip someone, it lends into the next move. It's like you kind of, one of you mentioned Jackie Chan. It is almost Jackie Chan-ish at times.
It's, I wouldn't say it's as I don't mean bad in it. I wouldn't say it's as severe as, if you go back to a lot of the 1970s Chinese martial arts films, that is a lot of, you know, that is very choreographed, almost like a dance, because that's obviously what a lot of the early Chinese martial arts came from, the whole theatre performance of what Chinese theatre was. It was a dance. So when they turned that into martial arts films, you had a lot of that. And then Jackie Chan in the 1980s made it a lot more flow a little bit better. But yeah, this film kind of takes it back to that slight...
Well, it's interesting you kind of saying about kind of that theatre vibe, and we've said already that it's kind of an epic. The fact it actually has an intermission in this film as well, it's like something that is obviously very rare in modern filmmaking. And I think that kind of adds to that sort of credence of what it's trying to achieve, really.
So they actually did that in the cinema?
Well, yeah, there was an intermission card. And Edgar Wright, I mentioned earlier, there's people that obviously praise the film, like James Cameron being one. But Edgar Wright said when he saw it at the cinema, he noted it was the only film where the intermission card itself got a round of applause from the audience, because that's how invested they were.
Damn.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Obviously, again, that kind of style of film. And I think the last one I can remember there being one of those types of things was actually a film that Edgar Wright was involved in, when it was like the Grindhouse, Tarantino and Planet Terror, where they kind of make fake trailers during that piece. But yeah, it's interesting that they kind of felt, again, it's a long film, that they kind of felt the need to separate it. But there is a lot of segments, as you mentioned earlier, the fact the 3 hours are kind of, it's almost like a pause of the film, and it's the big graphics of like what this is at those points. It's a film that's not afraid of basically taking risks and doing things that are perhaps a bit more old school or unconventional in terms of how it presents.
Well,
them.
Yeah.
So I just found that
really is really interesting. And kind of because I just watched it, you know, as a normal film, like, I don't know, you know, how that was, the fact that they intended people in the cinema to go have a break and come back is...
Bear in mind, I'm so old. When I used to go and see films in the early 80s, you had an intermission, whether you liked it or not. The last film I saw it with an intermission was at Enfield Cinema. Me and my friends went to see The Lion King, so 1994.
We should do that. There was the curse at some point, actually.
There was like an act break, and I was just like, oh my god! Like, I didn't think they still did this.
Wow. But
yeah, I used to go to the cinema in the '80s, and you would have a bear in mind, people used to be out smoking the cinema in the 1980s, which was crazy. But yeah, the curtains came when I went to see 101 Dalmatians. It was like a reissue. The Secret, the Sword, the He-Man and She-Ra movie, Superman Quest for Peace. I remember on all those occasions the red curtains coming across the screen. So, but it's a nice callback, because, I mean, you have to have it with a film this long.
Well, you say that, but most films don't. So you go and see the new Scorsese film that's coming out, The Killers of the Flower Moon. What's that going to be, like 3.5 hours or something?
Well, yourself. The British Empire discover that Raju is trying to betray them.
And they fuck him over and they put him in jail, and then it's basically a rescue.
And he grows a great long
and there's
long
another rescue for about the fourth time in the film.
So yeah, so now we get this crazily hilarious,
it's another huge set piece,
action
really,
scene where Behem rescues Raju, and he basically, because Raju can't walk because he's been in prison, he's been in like solitary confinement, he's been all kind of crouched, he can't really walk, so he gets on Behem's
shoulders.
It's like
the human centipede.
And they basically I wasn't thinking that grotesque, but I was thinking this reminds me of something like a transformer, where as a kid you had two transformers and you merged them into another transformer, and he was just as strong, and I was like, he's become like a giant transformer. They go crazy, but then this leads into the finale in the jungle.
Yeah, when Michael Bay runs out and says, like, I'm going to sue you all for stealing my Transformers gimmick.
Yeah. I was going to say, the interesting thing about this bit is when Raju basically finds his ancestry, as it were, and instead of being a member, he becomes, like, part of this almost bigger thing, and... he becomes like, oh my, he celebrates his heritage. He becomes basically the kind of the dude who deals out fire with arrows. We mentioned it earlier. I've got to go back to it. Don't waste the bullet on an Indian.
Yes.
Remember, that's the whole thing. The finale of this is like you've got the evil British
George
officer.
Lucas.
And George Lucas, we're going to call him Ray Stevenson.
Gets his
Death
Star shoved right up his... No, wait.
This is really interesting, this bit, because I was convinced he wasn't going to shoot him.
Because really?
Although
revenge
it's like,
great.
Yeah, no, revenge is great. And it's like, don't waste this bullet. I thought it was going to be like most films. It's like, oh, no, actually... We're too good.
I'm the
yeah,
bigger man.
We're too good for this.
Yeah.
Should he have killed him?
what you say, Smith, is also because I was thinking. You reminded me. I was thinking a similar thing of like, you know, you wouldn't waste the bullet on us. We're not even going to waste
yeah,
one
exactly.
on you.
Yeah.
But they.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
they. But I think they get around that with the structure when he goes. How can you waste this bullet? Return it. What is it? He says, I wrote it down. He says, return it to his heart. And I was like, oh, that's such a good
line.
But
yeah, it's brutal.
He just...
George Lucas is no more.
Kill the officer.
He can't
George
carry,
Lucas
can't
make
carry
make
on
any
making
more films.
Indiana Jones.
From what I've heard, that might be a good thing. No, he didn't make the last one, did he?
I'm sure he had his sticky paws in it somewhere or another, but yes.
And then after that, we have this again, like we said, only like maybe three of these kind of dances right at the end of the film where they look so different.
Even the director has a cameo in this dance. So it's kind of like the classic end credits scene.
It's like
everyone
coming
together,
in.
Really.
Like even.
Well, this is everyone's out of character. It's just a celebration of culture, yeah. Isn't it?
Nigel, you must have some trivia on this film.
Oh, Christ.
I've got a little bit of trivia. Well, it wasn't actually... It didn't win an Oscar or get nominated because it actually went with a different Indian film, which was a big disappointment. It just goes to show how restrictive the Oscars are, I suppose, in terms of... Like, each country, like the Indian Film Board, put forward a film for consideration as best foreign film. And this was not put forward, so
this
it
was
not considered.
This was not put forward.
No, they put something else forward, which is obviously a bit bonkers. But I guess it kind of looked at it as that kind of... This isn't a film that would traditionally do well in Oscars. You go back previous years, a big bombastic action film.
Superhero
film, essentially, yeah. So that's quite interesting. But I guess, like, we've touched on some of the points about, like, the RRR. So it actually had different abbreviations in different languages. And so it was called in Telugu, Tamali, Kannada, say Kannada, apologies if I'm butchering any pronunciations, it all translated to actually Rage, War and Blood rather than the Rise, Roar and Revolt that we saw in Hindi and English. So
was that again Rage, War and Blood?
Yeah, Rage, War and Blood.
I do
Blood.
Like that.
So that again, it's almost like Edge of Tomorrow that it's got two names. But and we talked about the opening scene, the opening scene for Ram Charan's character in the sense of he's fighting outside of the compound, and he called the action sequence basically the most suffocating stunt he'd ever done. And you can see completely understand why that would be the case. But every time the shot was finished and the director actually called cut, it took a while for the team who were filming and sorting it all out to actually find where he was because there was so much dust, so many people. And a guy was actually given a white flag just to wave at the assistant director to tell him where he actually was.
Oh my God.
Which is obviously insane. But he actually claims, the actor claims, he did not receive a single scratch after 30 days, which is the length of choreography required to shoot that scene.
I was just going to say, quite a question on trivia, do you know how long this film took to make? Because
originally it was cast around like mid to early 2019, and given it
really
wasn't released until 2022, I think it was a long time of like pre-production, production, everything else. Yeah, the film itself took over 300 days.
Okay,
wait, so
almost
a year.
But that's still quite a long time, I would say. And like I said, that one scene, that fight scene,
but
was 30 days.
For the, a year is a long time, but the amount of what goes into this film, I would have presumed it. But like, considering Avatar's taken about 40 years to make the second one.
And look, we're all still talking about Avatar 2.
Talking about what?
Please just have silence for about 30 seconds there, Smith.
And then the last bit of trivia, we kind of talked a tiny bit about some of the acting, the English actors especially, being a little bit wooden. Well, originally, someone known as Daisy Edgar-Jones, who you may be familiar with, who was in Sally Rooney's COVID Normal People on the BBC, was originally cast as lovely Jennifer, but had to drop out due to scheduling conflicts. But it would have been very interesting to see her in this film, because she's got a lot of acting credentials. I do feel quite harsh for the person that replaced her.
Olivia someone.
Olivia Morris, who valiant
something
as she is.
To the fact that, you know, the Indian cast are much bigger than the British, because if you suddenly start getting stars in, which they could afford to.
Oh, yeah, you could.
Couldn't you? You could have proper stars in this film as the English cast. It really takes away from, well, the whole point of the film, to be honest.
Agreed.
Okay, so let's see what Chris Kiernan, who recommended the film, gave this. So Chris had said, I'd give it an 8 out of 10 for the sheer joy of the epic tale, the dancing and the take on British cinema. I think it's a great Christmas film, even though it's not Christmassy. It's just a lot of fun and the spectacle.
Oh, right. Wow.
Fair enough, Chris. I'm not sure I can see the Christmas film thing, but fair enough. Whatever. Whatever you like to watch on Christmas Day. Nige? Oh, well, shall I go? I'll go. Okay, fine. Yeah, like I said, interestingly with this genre, it's not a genre I've seen, but after watching this film, it's made me really want to, like, kind of check out some more Bollywood films, and, you know, it's like an industry that is a bit untapped for me. So I was really pleased to kind of, like, well, see this kind of film. I had no idea what to expect. I loved the set pieces, the choreography. I thought the acting was awesome, although, like my point, like, some of the kind of woodenness of the British kind of annoyed me at times. I liked the fact that the CGI was almost video gamey, contrasted against the kind of realism and the brutality of the shockingness of, like, some of the other scenes, that especially with the, you know, the Empire and kind of what that means. It is absurd at times. It is utterly ridiculous, but it's meant to be, and that part of it is brilliant. There was a bit of a gripe for me, and I felt like this film ended about three times. I got to a point where I was like, okay, it's going to end now, and then there was still 45 minutes to go. And then I felt like there was a kind of a second ending and then a third ending. And I do feel like, I'm not just saying it because it's a 3 hour film, that I felt like this. I did just feel that it just tried to do that bit too much, to literally wrap everything up. And, you know, like, I felt like a couple of scenes maybe didn't need to be there. There was a scene with the flogging just before the flogging, and they go out and talk to everyone and say, come and see the flogging. And it's like, I don't think you needed that scene. I think, you know, there's scenes that could have been cut to make this film, in my opinion, stronger. So yeah, I'm a little bit conflicted, because I really, really loved aspects of it. I really loved the first hour, 2 hours, but then I actually found, like, there were moments where I checked out a bit in that final 45 minutes. But I have ended up overall at a 7 out of 10. So, solid. Yeah.
Fair do, sir.
So, for me, I went into this film quite excited. I was looking forward to seeing it. And as I mentioned, the way the two main characters are introduced, I absolutely thought, wow, this blew me away. And obviously the piece before that about the child getting kidnapped. What I really didn't like was the CGI. I did think it really took me out of it. I just thought it looked really cheap and not particularly well done. And especially the scene with all the animals, I just thought was really bad. Like, and the swinging from the bridge, just, I guess it kind of lost me around that point, and it never really got me back. I thought the English acting was, as mentioned, like wooden. I thought it was quite cheesy in some bits, but as much as I'm sort of slagging it off in that respect, there's some really brilliant moments. Like the bromance is fantastic. Like some of the set pieces, if you can kind of look past the CGI and look more at the choreography, like that scene where he's fighting outside of the compound is one of the best scenes I've seen in a scene. One of the best scenes I've had the pleasure of watching quite a long time. So I thought that was incredible. But like Smith, by the ending, I was really lagging. Like, it got to the point, I think the tipping point for me was that kind of whipping scene where he's getting punished in the square. And after that, it just, I completely lost engagement with the film. I quite enjoyed the songs and the dancing and the sort of, especially the bit, the drumming that first builds it up. So again, it's a film for me that's filled with highs and lows, I guess. And because it's highs and lows, I can't really give it that higher score. I totally understand why people love it. I totally understand why the director's going to be revered and people are going to look to do things with him. But for me, it kind of almost falls into the same kind of category as it's kind of like the John Wick films, where they're too overblown for me. Maybe if I was more in my kind of like my 80s mindset, I would have got more out of it. But I'm only going to give it a 6 out of 10. So for me, it just, the length especially, it just didn't hit the spot for me in that sense. Although, as said, there's some absolutely brilliant moments that you could easily suggest are a 9 or a 10 out of 10. There's bits that just let it down along the way for me.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Etog.
I think I may have broken Etok's heart. Let's see.
That's all right. Yeah, yeah. I totally understand your criticism, both of your criticisms of the film. It's a long old movie, and yeah, the CGI is definitely a bit ropey in places. And like, I can imagine it taking you out of the film. I really like this movie a lot. I like Nigel. I went in very excited, and I think it's fair to say that the first half is stronger than the second half. The first hour and a half, it's crazy to say that. The first hour and a half is stronger than the second hour and a half. And I can appreciate what you mean, Smith, by like the different endings. I come at it with a different kind of attitude in that I totally understand what you're saying. I thoroughly enjoyed this so much that I really didn't find myself worrying about, I wasn't clock watching, if you know what I mean. I was aware that it was a long old film, because I mean, when you first put it on, it's, you see the 3-hour timeline, you're like, oh, this is going to be a long old slog. But I just found I was in emotionally invested in every scene, and just it sounds really cheesy. Maybe that's the point of this film. But I kind of went on the journey with these characters. I thought, contrary to what you were saying, Smith, I kind of thought they painted Raju as quite a sympathetic character, in the fact that, yeah, he's a baddie until we know he's not. But they, you know, that bromance that he has with Beam really kind of, you get the sense that this is a good man. Maybe he's in the wrong environment, obviously being a part of the British Empire, and then it's revealed that he's not. But I thought, like, the film really flowed nicely for me. Like, I thought the dance numbers, like I said, that initial one they have at the ball blew me away. I was just so impressed with that. I agree with you what you guys say about the British acting. I think there's a part of it that, I know this is going to sound like me completely doing mental gymnastics with this. The way I looked at that was, you've got these, you know, they're the villains, and they are, because the British Empire was so awful, these are almost like Saturday morning cartoon villains. I mean that in the sense of, kind of, you don't want to present them too emotional, too deep, because they are villains. And don't get me wrong, obviously not. You've got like Jenny in it, who's I did like her acting and her character. I thought she was, you know, I believed in her chemistry with Beam on screen. But I understand what you mean by, like, you know, it's, they do come across quite flat and quite stilted in their dialogue. But again, I kind of like the idea that they're just the baddies. And can we just mention one shot that we didn't talk about in the film that I thought was fantastic? When they kill the bloke at the end, you see the image behind him of the British, the symbol of the British Empire, blood. The crown, and all the blood splatters it. And I was just like, that's all you really need. That could have been like the poster for the movie. Do you know what I mean? It was such a powerful image that the British Empire is built on bloodshed. I mean, that's my take from that image. But I thought cinematically it was a breathtaking film at times, surprisingly so. I thought the leads, both leads, Raju and Beam, were so charismatic. Visually, I understand, again, the CGI doesn't really work for some people, but I really came away loving this movie. Really loving this movie. So I'm going to give it a 9.5 out of 10.
Wow. Oh, wow.
I really liked it. I wasn't sure. You know, like I said, I'd seen a few clips and trailers and thought, oh, well, this looks like a fun movie, but I really got into this.
What is the reason it's not a 10 then? Why?
I would say probably the CGI. I think, like Nye said, it does kind of pull you out of those moments. But I think I was kind of going into this, you know, I think from those opening scenes of Raju and Beam, kind of when we see them for the first time doing their very superhero acts, I was kind of looking at this slightly in a superhero way. Yeah, I don't want to say that because I almost don't want to put the film in that category because I think it's better than
I think a lot of the critics have said a similar thing. Like, you're not alone in saying that.
The final thing I'll say about this film is it knows the story it's trying to tell. It knows the film it wants to be. I don't think it's trying to be anything it's not.
Yeah.
But shy away from it. Yeah, I really love this movie.
Nice. And guys, what do you think of email us on offradarpod@gmail.com, tweet us at offradarpodcast, let us know what you think about that. That's kind of split us a little bit, but yeah, write in and give us another film to watch.